Morning, everybody. Welcome back. We'll call the meeting to order, and Representative Reinert will move the minutes of the last Tuesday's meeting. Is it, or what do I got in here? Yeah. Okay. Thursday's meeting. Excuse me. Any additions or corrections? Not all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And first up, members, is we have the Office of Higher Education coming forward with a little presentation. Ms. Hegart, there you are. Welcome to the committee. And then we're going to be talking about financial aid programs. But I'm assuming that, Ms. Hegart, you're going to give us a little overview of the whole office first, and then we'll go into that.
Mr. Chair, what I'd like to do is I'll do a few slides first, just general overview, and then I'm going to hand the presentation off and step away and ask Mark and Meredith and Tricia to get into more details about the financial aid program. Does that work for you?
I thought you were going to tell us what the governor's going to do to balance the budget for you.
No? Mr. Chair, not quite yet.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for asking us to be here today. My name is Susan Hegart. I'm the Director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And I'm going to walk through the first few slides, and as I mentioned, Representative Rubina, I'm going to then hand the presentation off to get once we get into more detail about the numbers. Our office is a cabinet agency. On this slide, this is just sort of a breakdown of the statutory obligations that we have. We're an executive branch agency. We've been an executive branch agency for about 5 years. We're a coordinating board until the mid-90s. Then we were an independent agency until 2004, I believe, and since 2003, and then since then, we've been a cabinet agency. I'm part of the governor's cabinet, and then when it comes to testifying on behalf of the governor on the higher ed budget, our office assumes that responsibility now. We have a substantial policy and analysis function at the agency. We have lots of information on accountability. You've seen our Minnesota Measures report, I hope. If you haven't, please let us know. We've got a new version that should be out in a month or so. We have lots of data on enrollment, tuition, and financial aid. And we provide, as I mentioned, budget and policy advice to the governor. We have a consumer protection role as well. We regulate private institutions through licensing and registration. Those would be both nonprofit and for-profit institutions. We have some program coordination responsibility. We have the library programs, Minitex and MinLink. And we also have the Learning Network. And those of you particularly in greater Minnesota, will find tremendous value in the Learning Network. That basically is the pipeline getting the technology up to the door of the campus into those communities in greater Minnesota. We have an outreach and information function. We provide targeted college readiness support and information to students, primarily through our Gear Up grant from the federal government. That's a $15 million grant. We have some very low-income schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul where our staff works alongside teachers in those classrooms. But we also provide curriculum across Minnesota on helping students understand at a very early age, grade school and middle school, what they need to do to prepare for college. Our financial aid programs you may be most familiar with, we have grants. Those are monies that don't have to be paid back. We have one of the largest need-based grants in the country, state grant program. We have a loan program. It's a supplemental loan program called the STELP loan program. That's the acronym. So people who might use that would be those who can't qualify for a subsidized federal loan. They need a supplemental loan. And so they come to us. We offer a loan that's above the federal rate but below the bank rate. And you just have to have a co-signer. We oversee work-study programs, tuition reciprocity agreements. We had our big accomplishment, I think, last year when we got the Wisconsin reciprocity agreement figured out. We also have agreements with North and South Dakota and with Manitoba and a couple of schools in Iowa. We also have a state-sponsored college savings plan, the 529 plan. On the next slide, you'll see a distribution of the institutions around the state. You can see there's pretty good access geographically for students in the state, and then in the metro area there's a much greater concentration. That's where most of the students are. And if those dots represent the U of M, Minsky 2 and 4 year schools, private colleges, and the proprietary or for-profit schools. And now Mark Mishkanis is going to take over for me.
Mr. Chairman and members, again, for the record, my name is Mark Mishkamp with the Office of Higher Education. I've got four slides I want to go through, just create some context for you on enrollment and overall budget shares. So this would be the slide on page four. This is the 07 enrollment, and we've broken it down by the two-year community colleges that use, U of M, private 4 years, the career colleges, and the online schools. Let me make just 4 points. This is from the fall 07. 4 points about this. I mean, obviously, the community college has the biggest enrollment, and these are headcount numbers, not full-time enrollments, but headcount numbers. Clearly, the community colleges are the largest. Second point is that when you compare total enrollment at the state U's, the U of M, the private 4 years, the totals are fairly similar. That's very close. The third point is on the private career schools, they have the lowest bar, if you will, on the chart, but they are the fastest growing by far sets of institutions in the state. They have growth rates, double-digit growth rates, compared to some of the other institutions that are not that high. And then finally, there was just a bar on here for the private online schools. This is artificially high because this includes Walden and Capella that are both located in Minnesota, but they, of course, deliver services across the country or the world, if you will. So all the counts take place here, though. They're distributed in Minnesota simply because the headquarters are here. So not all the numbers in the bar are Minnesota students. The next chart, then, is a breakdown of undergraduate enrollment. We did an age split here between those 24 and older and those age 25, I'm sorry, 24 and younger and age 24 and older, and showed where they are attending both in two-year and four-year institutions. The real point of this chart, Mr. Chair members, is that our agency and all its programs are concerned about all students, whether they're traditional younger students that go to four-year institutions or the part-time students that are older and go to two-year institutions. But you can see the breakdown of, obviously, many of the younger students do attend full-time at four institutions, and there's a split then on the two-year side. The next chart then shows higher education. This is a general fund only, doesn't include all funds. This is from the forecast in November for 08 and 09. Higher education, that includes appropriations to Minsky, the University of Minnesota, our office, and a small amount from the Mayo Clinic. It's about 9% of the general fund total for the biennium, for the current biennium of 08 and 09. This has been relatively flat for the last couple of years, although at one point, looking back historically, not in front of you, but that appropriation was upwards to 13% of the total general fund. And then finally, as a context chart, Mr. Chair, this shows you, again, this is for the 08-09 biennium from the November forecast. These are just higher education funding and the split of the roughly a little more than $3 billion that goes into the various institutions. See the split between U of M at 43%, Minsky at 44%. Our office gets about the remaining, about 13% of the total, and over 92% of that goes out in student financial aid. That's the state grant program, a number of the other programs that Director Hagar indicated, childcare, things like that. On that smaller pie chart, the 6% other programs, the largest two pieces there for the MuniTech program and the Learning Network, and then our administrative budget to run everything is about 2% of the total. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn things over to Meredith Fergus on the financial aid programs.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I'm a policy analyst for the Office of Higher Education and most specifically working with the Minnesota State Grant Program. It is my goal today to provide you with a brief financial aid overview. Financial aid actually comes from a variety of sources, be those federal, state, private, as well as institutional aid, and takes a variety of forms, grants, scholarships, work studies, and loans. Financial aid will differ based on whether the student is a dependent student, an independent student, or whether the student is enrolled full-time or part-time. Grants and scholarships are often the most well-known form of aid, and that is aid that does not have to be repaid. It is often awarded for both income as well as academic merit reasons. The federal grant program provides lower-income students with awards ranging from $400 to $4,731 per year. The award does not vary by the type of college the student attends, and it generally reaches families with incomes up to $55,000. A second federal program is the SEOG program, the Supplemental Educational Opportunity Grant. Under this program, the lowest income students can be awarded an additional $4,000 in grant aid. This program has limited resources, though, and is often awarded to Pell Grant recipients with the lowest incomes first. Other federal programs include the Academic Competitiveness Grant as well as the SMART Grant. Both of those federal programs provide grants to lower-income students meeting specific academic requirements. Among the state programs are included the Minnesota State Grant Program. It is the largest state-sponsored need-based program in the country. The program is coordinated with the federal Pell Grant Program. The maximum combined award with Minnesota State Grants and the federal Pell Grant ranges from approximately $5,789 for students attending public two-year colleges to $8,661 per year for students attending four-year colleges. The average state grant award is approximately $2,000, and the minimum award is $100. Other state programs include the Achieve Scholarship, which is a one-time award based on academic merit as well as financial need of $1,200, as well as the Post-Secondary Child Care Grant.
Excuse me, Ms. Ferguson, and if the committee has any questions, particularly with the state grant program, you can chime in any time, but since you mentioned Achieve, Ms. Hegard, were you going to say anything on Achieve today or later on, maybe?
Sure, they're going to go through kind of the technical details on the program.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry I interrupted. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The final group of institutional grants is institutional grants and scholarships. These are monies awarded by each college. And these can be awarded based, again, by income, financial need, or academic characteristics. Included in this category would be public programs, such as the Founders Scholarship, as well as the Power of You monies that are awarded by a specific institution. Students can also earn scholarship and grant money from private and community foundations, such as the Rotary Club, as well as the Gates Scholarship and the Page Scholarship. The final three categories of financial aid would include work study, student loans, as well as federal tax credits and deductions. Student loans are often provided by the federal government, the state of Minnesota, as well as private lenders. The largest student loan program is the Federal Stafford Loan Program. There are two types of Stafford loans, subsidized, during which the interest that accrues while the student is enrolled is actually paid by the federal government, and unsubsidized, in which the interest that is accrued simply is repaid by the student after they complete their degree or after they stop enrollment. Subsidized loans are generally only available to the lower income students. Students are allowed to borrow between $5,500 and $7,500 per year from the Federal Stafford Loan Program. An additional $4,000 per year becomes available if the student is an independent student or if the student's parents fail to qualify for a federal parent's loan. Other loan programs include the Minnesota Self-Loan Program, the Federal Parents Loan, or the PLUS Loan Program, as well as alternative loans provided by banks. Interest rates as well as repayment requirements vary by program and lender.
Mr. Chairman, your state grants, I'm assuming they are only offered to residents of Minnesota. Am I correct? Okay.
Residents attending a Minnesota institution.
Thank you.
And it'll actually go into...
To that point, then, maybe Mr. Mishkans, like for Capella and the other Minnesota-based Walden, then you should be able to pull the Minnesota students out of their total numbers there, right?
Mr. Chair, only if they receive the grant, and they're under, this is only for undergraduates as well. Capella focuses on graduates.
So there's a little more difficult.
Chair, if I could, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. We do have enrollment data based on residency, so we could provide the statistics a little bit differently so you'd see the Minnesota residents that are among those that enrollment at Capella and Walden.
A little more accurate. Thank you. Excuse me, Mrs. Ferguson. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go ahead and move ahead to, this is an actual pie chart that shows the distribution of institutional grants and scholarships to Minnesota undergraduates during fiscal year 2007. Total combined grants and scholarships for Minnesota students exceeded $864 million in that single fiscal year.
Is there a way to break down in the institution grants and scholarships how many of them are public dollars and private?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's actually available in the Office of Higher Ed's report, Financial Aid Awarded. It's actually broken out by sector of institution, public four-year, MISU four-year, University of Minnesota. That data is available. Members, this is a listing of the other state financial aid programs that are administered by the Office of Higher Education. And we simply provided some statistics on the number of students who are receiving each type of financial aid, as well as total dollars. One note, the state work study program, 11,000 students earned $20 million. Of that, the state appropriation was 12.4. Some institutions do overmatch or provide additional matching funds, additional funds on top of their state required match.
Mr. Chair, you asked in particular about Achieve Scholarship. This is an estimate for fiscal year 2009, and our current estimate is that about 2,400 students will be receiving the Achieve Scholarships and will receive a total of $3 million. Achieve Scholarships are a new program in which students who take a college preparatory set of courses in high school and come from families with incomes under $75,000 can get a one-time grant of up to $1,200 to help pay for their first year of enrollment. Did you want more details than that about Achieve Scholarship, sir?
Well, it's just for the new members, and for the other members carried over from the last biennium. You remember the governor had asked for quite a bit more money than he got, and then I can't remember if we were able to take a little bit of money when we had the balancing budget bill last year or not. I don't think we proposed it, but we didn't end up with that proposal, right, Ms. Cannon?
Mr. Chair, last year we were basing our estimates at one point on the federal grants under the notion that the same student should qualify for both. That's in the range of 5,500 students. And for whatever reason, that we're not quite sure of yet, because we've been beating the bushes trying to get students to show up for this grant because it's money in their pocket. Not that many students have showed up, as Ms. Guyton says, about 2,400 of roughly 55. I mean, there's some things going both directions, but so for that reason, we last year said that we thought we needed the full appropriation at that time, and clearly that hasn't turned out to be the case.
And so what's left in the pot for the balancing budget for the rest of this biennium?
Mr. Chair, we actually have a couple of appropriations going both directions, if you wanted me to talk about those right now.
Perhaps we don't, but right now. I'm curious. We put a cap, if I remember, in 07, as you said, at 75 grand of income. Where has the usage of breaking it down in some sort of income brackets, maybe that you're using, who's using it most, on the upper end of the economic scale or the lower end?
Mr. Chair, you are correcting your guess. About half of the recipients come from families with incomes of 45 to 75,000, and the other half come from under 45,000. We would have expected it to be a little bit different, but it is true that the upper half of that income distribution is where that most of the eligible students are coming from.
I can't remember. They have to go to school in Minnesota, or so?
Mr. Chair, they have to graduate from the Minnesota High School.
Right.
And they have to have taken a college preparatory curriculum, something on the order of 4 years of English, 3 years of math and science, 2 years of a foreign language, or they have to have taken post-secondary enrollment options courses or advanced placement tests that essentially are the equivalent.
Right, I remember. It's drafted loose enough that I can actually get a scholarship, too. Right, being not that smart. But the usage as far as those taking advantage of it, then, are they going to public institutions, private institutions? Let's break them.
Mr. Chair, as I recall, it was 76 institutions across the state, and it was a real mix of public and private institutions. There were more recipients at four-year institutions than at two-year institutions.
And you must have a breakdown of whether those, or what was public and private.
Right. I'm sorry, I don't have that in my head, but we did submit a report that was due January 15th that has all those breakdowns in it. It's only about a five-page report, so it's not a particularly long one, but it does have those kinds of statistics in it.
All right. Anything else to add? Well, excuse me, Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to piggyback on your question in terms of or your comment about your qualifying for the Achieve Scholarship. Further question, when we reviewed this initial proposal, there was a lot of discussion on the criteria for eligibility, and at that time, I think we made some suggestions that we might put in place a review process for those criteria, whether by high school staff, post-secondary staff, some group of people in the field that would judge whether the criterion are the appropriate ones designed to target the right students to actually achieve, to be a motivator for them to move forward with post-secondary education. What I'm wondering is that review process in place, you know, what's happening with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reiner, that review process did not actually end up in the final legislation. We do try to keep in touch with high school counselors in particular, and financial aid administrators and others involved in high schools to try to make sure that the curriculum are appropriate. The requirements to get the Achieve Scholarship are essentially the state high school graduation requirements. The only exception to that is the requirement for 2 years of foreign language. Other than that, the requirements are essentially identical to the state high school graduation requirements.
Ms. Ferguson?
Mr. Chair and members, if there are no other questions at this time, I could walk you through the state grant model and how the actual awards are calculated.
Go ahead.
Okay. As I said before, the Minnesota State Grant Program is a state-funded need-based grant program for Minnesota residents attending a college in Minnesota. The students can choose to attend both public as well as private institutions, and we do allow students to be full-time or part-time, three or more credits. The grant amount is actually based on the price of attendance as well as the student's financial need. Students apply for the grant using the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or the FAFSA. This is the same application that students use to apply for federal student aid, as well as for the federal Pell Grant program. The maximum award is $86.61 in the current year, and the average award is approximately $2,000. The award is coordinated with the federal Pell Grant program, and it distributes the price of attendance first to the student as they benefit from the education, and then to their family, and then to taxpayers as needed. The actual state grant program first starts with the price of attendance. Under current statute, the maximum recognized price at a four-year institution with a living and miscellaneous expense allowance is just over $16,000, which is represented by the top of this chart. Students then are first asked to cover 46% of the price of their enrollment, and that is demonstrated by the bars you see before you. It is 46% regardless of income. All students are asked to contribute that. The next part that comes in is actually the assigned family responsibility. The assigned family responsibility is designated by the blue bars shown in this chart. Using data from the FAFSA, the federal government calculates what is known as the expected family contribution. This takes into account the family's income and assets, as well as their number of children, the number of children in college, as well as the student's status as a dependent or independent student. From this calculation, the financial expectation that the state places on the students is shown in the blue bar. It is modified slightly from the federal expectation. The next step is actually the application of federal tax dollars in the form of the federal Pell Grant. And these are shown by the green bars. The federal Pell Grant is simply the maximum federal Pell Grant allowed by law, currently 4731, subtracting the student's expected family contribution. The final component for determining the student's state grant award is, of course, the state grant award itself, which would fill in the gap between the top of the green or blue bars and the top of the chart, as shown in the dark green here. Next, Ms. Rangs will actually show you the distribution of state grants and how it varies by income.
Mr. Chair and members, on this slide that says net price and income at the top, what you were seeing before was the state grant model, and it was constrained by the amount of tuition we recognized as part of the state grant process and the living allowance we recognized as part of the state grant process, both of which are limited as a way of living within the amount appropriated.
This chart starts with the actual tuition and fees charged by each institution, the posted or sticker price, as you would, and it adds $10,000 as a living allowance, which is the average the students actually spend, if you look at census data, on room and board, clothing, books, transportation to and from campus, and so forth. And so this is what you might call a more real-world price. And then we subtracted all the different kinds of grants, federal, state, institution, and private grants that students can get. And as you can see, as a result of all the financial aid that goes out in the form of grants and scholarships, there is a lower price at lower incomes than there is for students at higher incomes, but the net price that students are left with there is still a very substantial portion of family income. All right, this particular chart looks at net price and income at the University of Minnesota, and here you can see that we've added together the assigned student responsibility plus the assigned family responsibility that the state grant program expects of students and their families. We call it assigned family responsibility because the federal terminology of expected family contribution leaves a little something to be desired. It's not a voluntary contribution, and it's an amount that's rather somewhat arbitrarily assigned. It's related to income, but it's somewhat arbitrarily assigned. So in Minnesota, we call it the assigned family responsibility. And here you can see by looking at the blue line, the actual net price the university students tend to face. The reason the net price is lower than the assigned family responsibility plus the assigned student responsibility up to about $60,000 is because of University of Minnesota scholarship programs such as the Founders Scholarship and other scholarships, many of which are funded by privately donated dollars. The reason it's higher as you go above $60,000 is that we do not recognize in calculating the state grant the full amount of tuition charged at the University of Minnesota. So when you look at the price is recognized in the state grant program, they do not continue to go up with income because they've been arbitrarily constrained by the tuition cap.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to just pause here for a moment. I'm going to suggest to you and the members that these two charts are actually, I think, the most important ones that we've done since I've been in this office, because it really does give you a picture of the reality that parents and kids and their children face when they show up at college. Once all the institutional money and the public money are just put in place, this is the challenge. Now, these are averages, so that makes it difficult sometimes. But you know, I mean, I'm not going to suggest that you should take this home if you're a student who defined grade next year and say, oh, this is our situation at the University of Minnesota, because these are averages. But the information contained in these charts is, I think, for you to think about in a policy sense, is these are the real challenges faced by, again, by parents. And their families. And there's a lot of dense information, isn't it? I just wanted to take just a moment if there are questions about it.
Representative Coffey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question about, this is a single student graph, or is this multiple students in a family? How would that be depicted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coffey, this assumes that it's a dependent student from a family of four with one student in college.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a student or a family that has two or three students in college, what kind of responsibility do you have grasped for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coffey, we do not have them handy, but in general what happens if you have two or more students in college at the same time is the expected family contribution is simply divided by two or by three. They don't assume that the family can somehow magically come up with more money because more students happen to be attending at the same time.
Any other questions? That's me. Okay. Then whoever's going.
Chair, I'm going to hand it back to Ms. Burgess.
Thank you, Member. In fiscal year 2008, the Minnesota State grant was received by over 83,000 undergraduates. Combined federal, as you can see from this chart, approximately 72% of recipients had incomes less than $40,000. In terms of dollars awarded, combined federal and Minnesota state grants totaled $301 million in fiscal year 08. Of that, $149 million was state grants. The largest combined dollars, of course, go to the lowest income students.
We do have several reports that have more detailed information about the state grant, as well as kind of information for low-income students. These would include the Minnesota State Grant Review, enrollment patterns for low-income students, and the Minnesota State Grant end-of-year statistics, all of which are available on the office's website.
Okay. Questions of the committee, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is really for any of the testifiers. I just did some quick math, and you were indicating that 83,000 students received some form of financial aid. And I went to page 4, enrollment at Minnesota's colleges and universities, and just totaled up the number of just under, well, it's 275,000 students. And so I'm asking, my question is, we have 275,000 students in college at any one time and only 83,000 of them getting state aid grants, and so less than a, what would that be, a third?
Mr. Chair, okay. Representative Mahoney, the state grant money only applies to undergraduates, so you would need to look at just the undergraduate portion of those statistics. It's our understanding that about 1 in 4 undergraduate students in Minnesota get the state grant.
Representative Mahoney.
So, Mr. Chair, and we have the largest state grant program in the nation, and we're only helping 25%?
Ms. Grant.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, actually, that was a little bit of misspoken. We have among the largest state grant programs in the country, in particular, large in sort of per undergraduate terms. It's not nearly as large as, for example, New York and California.
So I'll rephrase my question. As one of the largest state grant states in the nation per capita, we're only helping 83,000 kids or people out of almost 300,000.
Mr. Chair.
And what happens?
That's correct.
I'll answer. Then what happens to the other 160,000? Are they just relying on moms, dads, and their own pocketbook?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, many of them are working while enrolled. 83% of Minnesota students work while enrolled, and many of them also do take out student loans. But they are very likely to be getting money from their families as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll leave you. After last year, I think I'll leave you to talk about the student loans. Because I do know that members, that was an issue for you. Thank you.
Members, that is why I wanted early on to have the discussion, at least bring in some folks, and maybe before I call on Representative Atkins, it's a good segue into why. You know, we give off $420 million a biennium for our grant program here and loans and everything else, financial aid. And I don't think that includes the public money like the university gave out on that matching grant program we required, or the Iron Range scholarship they gave out, or other things like that. So, you know, that's why we have some people coming from the university today and MNSCU and privates to tell us the importance of the program. But hearing what the governor said last week, unless we go to you know, all technology or something, we're going to have a big job ahead of us this year, and some of this money could be on the chopping block, or a reorganization of it could be in the making. So I wanted you to early on get some of the experts to tell us the importance of it, and then when we're having to make up decisions, remember the discussion, perhaps. Representative
Mr. Chair, it seems to me, I recall, I don't know if it was you nice folks that provided it last time, but there's a chart out there that shows the average debt with which a typical student graduates, both at a public institution and a private. If you happen to know those numbers offhand, but what I'm really interested in seeing is how has that progressed over the last, say, 5 or 10 years? Because my sense is that it's grown dramatically over the last decade.
Mr. Chair, graduating class of 2007 in Minnesota, roughly 68% of students who graduated from public four-year institutions had student loans, and they averaged about $22,500. For students at private colleges, 74% had student loans, and they averaged about $27,500. And you are correct. The percent with loans and the amount that they have borrowed in loans has been increasing faster than either tuition or inflation for about the last 20 years.
Thank you. Representative Horn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any statistics on how long it's taking these kids, these students, to repay their college loans? Is it 10 years or is it 25 years?
Mr. Chair, the typical sort of the default repayment plan is 10 years, but students who borrow larger amounts may well opt for an extended repayment plan that may go as far as 20 years. What we have is an imperfect indicator called the federal cohort default rate on student loans, which takes the group of students that should have gone into repayment in a given year and sees whether they default on their loan payments within the next 2 years after they were supposed to start repaying their loan. And in Minnesota, that rate is under 5%. As I recall, it's about 4%. I don't remember the precise 3.7 or something like that, but I can't recall the exact amount.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. You know, I've got the pleasure of having a policy committee for you this year, and I made it my point to go out and talk to business owners over the summer, having an inkling that this might happen, this structure. You know, and by and large, every business owner I talk to, workforce and an educated workforce is in their number one spot or number two spot that helps them stay profitable in the state of Minnesota. We've got our work cut out for us trying to figure out how we keep that in mind.
We do. Mr. Michigan, are you going to stay up there or not? Or who's someone going to stay with OHC? We might as well have Mr. Zetterberg, and unless there are any other questions or comments from OHC.
Mr. Chair, we had some examples of student awards on the next three or four pages.
Okay, Representative Madison, did you have a question first? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, this is going on a different vein altogether than what you've heard so far. When it comes to the state grants and the different loans that are out there that are provided by the state, it's been a long time since I've been in college, and I'm trying to remember, what kind of requirements do you have and how that money is being used?
Mr. Chair, they start with what's called the campus budget, which is tuition and fees plus an allowance for the expenses of being enrolled, such as room and board and books and transportation and so forth. And the total amount the student borrows can typically not exceed the campus budget minus the other financial aid they're receiving. So they start with the campus budget, which was, say, was $16,000. They subtract all the grants and scholarships the student gets, and then the federal loans and other loans can fill the remaining up to the total price of attendance. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chair, maybe this is something that is of the past, but I remember when I went to college, one of my good friends received a lot of financial assistance, and he used the money that he received from the state in ways that I wouldn't say were pursuing or were achieving his educational goals. And I'm just curious, is that something of the past, or is that something that currently happens?
Mr. Chair.
Representative, we still have that beer allowance up at the Northeast United States, but I believe that's what, you know.
Mr. Chair, there's no guarantee about exactly how a student uses the funds. Typically, the school, the loan goes to the school usually, and so they make sure that their tuition and fees and any charges they have for the student get paid. So if it's a private institution that tends to have room and board, also that they make sure it gets paid out of the proceeds of that loan. But there is no way of policing precisely how they use those dollars. They do have to repay them later on.
But just for the information to the committee, I would suspect that most of the money is eaten up in the example you just gave, whether it's a public or private, before there's any left over to party with, I would assume.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that's happened is tuition has increased fairly rapidly over the last 10, 15 years, and so frequently there's not a lot of money left over by the time tuition and fees and any other charges from the campus have been paid.
Representative Breiner and then Representative Dunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Grimes, you noted that student loans are rising faster than either tuition or inflation, and I'm wondering if any analysis of that has been done. I mean, there's three options that occur to me. One is that families are contributing less, the other is students are spending more, and the third is that students are working fewer hours. Do we have any idea about what factors are there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reinert, the research is that tuition has gone up rapidly and students are paying about the same amount out of pocket as they would have paid adjusted for inflation perhaps 15 or 20 years ago, and they're making up the difference basically out of student loans. In fact, students are probably working more hours per week than they used to work. 83% of students work while they are enrolled.
Mr. Chair, I must have not heard correctly what you originally said then, because did you not say that student loans were increasing more rapidly than either tuition or inflation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reinert, yes, they are. That has been the rate of increase. But people who've done an analysis of sort of what the family had to come up with out of pocket in terms of money from the family to pay is roughly similar in inflationary terms now to what it was 15 to 20 years ago. The difference has been, the biggest difference has been student loan. Student work also has been a part of the picture.
Thank you.
So the student, his or herself, is picking up more of the debt, whereas in past times the family was helping out. They can't help out anymore, I guess, could be the assumption. Representative Thelney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not sure who is the appropriate person for this question. We're focused kind of exclusively on the cost side of the equation here. Do you correlate these kind of cost trajectories with, quote-unquote, the value to the graduate, either job placement rates or average starting income for the people departing? I guess the assumption is that families make an intelligent decision about the investment they're making in school. Is there anything that would substantiate that, yes, that equation is the same, better, or worse?
Mr. Chair, members, it's not clear to me whether it's improved. Certainly, the return on investment for education is substantial. I mean, the number that's kind of the street number is that a college-educated person makes $1 million over their lifetime relative to a high school-educated person. That kind of rate of return has changed over time. It was much better, I think, in the 80s. It started to decline in the 90s. It was really, actually, when many of us were getting out of college in the 70s, it was terrible because there were so many baby boomers. So that has changed over time. But clearly, the rate of return is very positive for students.
Specifically, job placement rates and average starting incomes, do you track that across different types of institutions to know whether those have improved as well along the way with the increased investment on the part of families and kids?
Sure, and members. The only institutions that have to actually report job placement rates are the private for-profit institutions. Non-profits and public institutions don't do that. So it's hard to track. For instance, if a person graduates with a certain degree and ends up in a certain occupation, we can track occupational wages. We don't do that in our office. He does that. That's available. But the direct tracking between an institution and the way it's paid is not something that we do.
Mr. Chairman, there has been some data collected on things like unemployment rate by educational attainment. And unemployment amongst those with a college degree or more is about half to a third of what the overall unemployment rate is. So in general, it's safe to say college graduates tend to have an easier time getting a job than those who do not have a college degree.
Representative Anderson, did you have another question? Or did Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To anyone that would like to answer this, we've talked about the students' increased costs. What is the institution's increased costs relating to inflation and so forth? They could be having a higher increase in costs than the students or inflation by far.
Mr. Chair, members, a report was just published, national report, within the last few weeks, the Measure Net report, which was put out by Pat Callen and other folks at the National Center for Higher Education Public Policy, I believe it's the title. And they did do a chart that shows inflation rates in higher education compared to medical costs, other costs, CPI and average, things like that. And certainly, and this doesn't measure the kind of inflation that you're talking about at the institutional level. And I don't recall what their starting date was, but certainly over the last period of time that they indicate inflation rates in higher education are above almost everybody else's. I think they may even exceed health care costs as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along those same lines, how does Minnesota compare for tuition rates in relation to the rest of the nation?
Mr. Chair, members, well, let me give you four numbers that some comparables. The University of Minnesota is about fifth in the Big Ten. At the Minsky, it's a four-year comprehensive, roughly speaking, it's in the range of number 15 or 16 compared to other states across the country. That's a state comparison, not an institute comparison. Our tutors, on a comparable basis, are the most expensive. They're ranked rated third in the country, and they have been there for quite a while.
Okay, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was trying to read something the other night and had the television on and kind of listening to both, and they were doing this piece on what kids earned and what the value of a college education was. And we've all heard the end-all evidence of the taxi cab driver with the JD degree, and that he made more money.
Good way fun, but anyway.
Do you have statistics or information on the value of a two-year program versus the value of a four-year? And this goes to the question of families making smart decisions. Because I do know kids come out of St. Paul Technical College making, absolutely excellent livings, better than some CPAs and less aggravation than some medical doctors. So,
Mr. Chairman, remember, we did a study a few years back. It wasn't one that we released, but we did kind of look at some of those questions. Again, these are averages, but on average, a student from a four-year college will tend to make more coming out relative to a three-year institution. The thing that surprised us is that even some education actually pays. You don't have to necessarily have a certificate, even or a diploma at a two-year school, to see your wage, your annual income grow relative to not having that.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in that, the four-year college degrees, are you including the Bill Gates and the what's the guy from Apple that is worth or makes, $60 billion versus the fellow that comes and testifies in front of the committee here?
Mr. Chair, and members, actually Bill Gates, I don't think graduated from college, but...
But I bet you somebody still claims them.
Again, these are averages, and I think that tend to wash out this lone individual. They're based on samples. If Bill Gates ended up in the sample, I would be surprised to keep him in there, but...
Mr. Chair, I would never put anything past a college trying to promote itself.
Well, like to tell everyone, the problem with averages is the average height and weight of the Iron Range delegation is 6'2" and 260 pounds, and then I walk in the room. So, actually, that figure's come down since Representative Dill went on his diet, but not much. Anyway.
Yeah, it's
been a week. I'll tell you, why don't we have, since your examples, Ms. Burgess, you stay at the table, and your examples include a university student, a private college student, and a community college student, so I think it would be good for our other guests to come down now, and you can give your examples, and they can chime in and add to, or whatever. Do we have Ms. Ruby here? Who's here from... Okay. Oh, Mr. Lopez is here for or Mr. Haynes. Okay, and then I assume this is Ms. Ruby coming. Okay, welcome to the committee. Members, it's good. Let's just go right ahead then, Ms. Burgess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The office has put together a couple of financial aid examples just to give you an idea of how the various kinds of grants and scholarships work together. The first example, we have a dependent student who comes from a family earning approximately $25,000 a year. They filed a FAFSA application, and the federal government determined that their expected family contribution is $0. They really are a needy family. This student, we show them with a price of attendance,
which in this category is simply tuition, fees, and room and board, of $11,293 for tuition and fees, an additional $7,280 in room and board costs. In addition to these two amounts, you would also add some sort of supplemental amount for books as well as other personal expenses, transportation home, such as Christmas or at the end of the year, beginning of the year. As far as financial aid, a student with an expected family contribution of zero would receive the maximum Pell Grant award of $4,731. The student would also receive a state grant of $3,930. We awarded this student a Minnesota Achieve Scholarship, which is that one-year award of $1,200, as well as an example of institution grants totaling $682, giving them a combined grant total of $11,293. This student and their family, of course, would then be required or expected to pay the remaining $7,280 out of a combination of work, loans, or savings. So that's our first example.
Curtis, would a student with that type of obligation, with that small of a family income, would that type of student, for instance, on the Minnesota, financial aid on the work grant, would they have qualified before someone else? Work study program that we augment with state money. Would they qualify for that before?
Well, Mr. Chair, they are very low-income students, so I could definitely see them being work study eligible, but those funds are determined by the institution.
So maybe Mr. Zetterberg or Ms. Alves or Ms. Ruby could answer that question.
Mr. Chair, I'm Peter Zetterberg. I work for the University of Minnesota. Yes, the lowest income student would definitely be offered work study as part of their financial aid package.
As a policy or a rule, or
as a standard practice we've had for many years.
And I'm Kathy Weeby from St. Olaf College, and at St. Olaf, any needy student is awarded work study, so the student would definitely qualify for work study.
Let's see.
Mike Lopez, with the Office of the Chancellor. The practice is the same at the institutions. The work study money, being a relatively limited amount of money, is awarded to the lowest income students.
Go ahead.
The next example we provide, Mr. Chair, is for a private college student. This student also has a family income of $25,000, as well as an expected family contribution of zero. However, they do face higher tuition fee costs, but a comfortable room and board cost. The student did receive the maximum Pell Grant as well as a state grant of $3,390. We did award the student a federal academic competitiveness grant of $750 as well as the Minnesota Chief Scholarship. The difference here is private colleges, institutional grants and scholarships tend to be larger on average. Using the data that we have at the office for averages, we awarded the student $10,437, giving them total grants of $21,048. The remaining difference, the price after grants, is just under $14,000.
Okay. Ms. Ruby, do you want to comment on anything out there, or anybody have any questions?
I think I'll wait. Okay. I'll put it in context later.
Thank you. Finally.
Mr. Chair, the remaining example we have is a community college student. For this one, we actually selected a 25-year-old independent student. They did not have children, the students. They made an annual adjusted gross income of $17,000 last year. They are subject to different income and asset rules under the calculation of the expected family contribution. This student is expected to contribute just over $3,600 to the cost of their education. At a community college, we provided this student with tuition fees of $4,838, as well as room and board costs, which oftentimes would reflect market rate rents for the area, of $7,990. We awarded this student a Pell Grant based on their ESC of $3,600 of $1,081 and a Minnesota State Grant of $2,426. Total grants for this student are just over $3,500. Leaving them to cover the remaining $9,300 in educational costs with work and loans.
Okay, questions, but I guess I have a comment before we start this. We're having trouble getting rid of the achieved scholarship, but we gave 2 out of 3 on these examples, so they're a little skewed there. You might as well give them 3 out of 3.
Mr. Chair, we like to assume that all students will get it once.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And also, we're not comparing, you know, the same income levels, et cetera. I guess on the last one, as to the other one.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We wanted to make you aware of that independent students do often face different contribution requirements.
I realize that, and have that student has a bigger obligation than the person going to the U. So anyway, Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if Minsky has an average tuition and fees rate that for a four-year college that we could use to guess.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, Chris Holling was scheduled to appear at the committee. He had a family emergency over the weekend, so he's not able to be here. Unfortunately, I'm not as well prepared as he would have been, and so I don't have that on top of my head, but I see Ms. Fergus is looking for that and may be able to find it.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I don't have it in front of me. Mr. Chair, excuse me. Actually, we have the Office of Higher Ed has 2 publications, Your Guide to Paying for College for Students and Families, as well as a Student Introduction to Paying for College, a Focus on Financial Aid, as well as the Get Ready website, www.getreadyforcollege.org, which helps students and families find the information on financial aid. And the numbers I see for our averages for 2008-2009 was $6,373 for state university for tuition and fees.
That sounds right to my committee administrator, Representative Brown.
$6,300.
Yeah. Well,
just a quick question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The FAFSA form, if there's anything I get lots of complaints about, it's the wonders of filling that out each year and how it times up against your doing your taxes and all of that. You have to do that every year, I assume, if you're going to qualify for aid.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, yes, you do.
Everyone's nodding in agreement. Representative Atkins, at that point, I don't know if you saw, I think it was in maybe late summer, early fall, where someone had when looking at students that actually qualify for federal loans and that, than those that actually apply, there's a lot more that,
right,
you know, would qualify but don't think they do, so they don't. So they were going to, somebody had the bright idea, we should have a person on every campus that does this, but I'm thinking, wouldn't the smartest way just be to say you can't sign for any credits until you fill out this form?
Yeah, sure.
Or is that too? That's just an Iron Ranger thing. Maybe there's a reason why you can't do it that way, but it would seem to be the easiest way to do it.
And actually, my point was that apparently, and I haven't had the good fortune of getting the opportunity to go through it quite yet, but evidently it's a very daunting process to go through. And I'm just curious if there's, you know, while I don't, I wouldn't expect them to waive the requirement that it be done each of the 4 years, if there isn't some way to take last year's form and tweak it to reflect this year's circumstances. Maybe you all do this for a living. I'm assuming that you are on down that road.
And maybe it has something to do with, you know, you have to be current. In your case, you know, that would be climbing that family share. But
well, I'm guessing we'll qualify for all kinds of aid and grants. I'm just going to put down my legislator salary.
Here you go. Then all of our kids and grandkids get to go for free if you use that.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Having worked in the field for 22 years, we are actually at the mercy of the federal government as that form is designed. But I will say that in recent months and years, there's been a move afoot to simplify the form and to look into data matches between the IRS and the federal and the Department of Education, ways to simplify it so that as you're filing your taxes, as your child is growing up, that's compiling the data necessary. There's a variety of ideas out there. And we're expecting with the change in administration there'll be a real look at simplifying that process, maybe by the time you get there.
Just one follow-up question. Is there still quite a difference between what the privates call for and what the public universities seek as far as income and asset data?
There is a difference, but not among all privates. Most of the privates in the state only require the free application for federal student aid. Carleton, McAllister, and St. Olaf and Gustavus makes it optional. It does require an additional form from the College Board. And we use that form to award our institutional dollars, because sort of the flip side of simplification is that the formula gets so simple that for people with more complicated finances, it's hard for us to assess true need. So we collect additional information as we're awarding our institutional funds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Backens, as to your point about whether or not it's necessary to do it every year, you would be surprised how much financial situations change from year to year. For families, as an example, of the students who are Pell eligible when they matriculate at the University of Minnesota, only 50% of them will remain Pell eligible for 4 years. The expected family contribution for a student may be zero 1 year, and it may be $10,000 the next, for any number of reasons. Maybe one parent lost a job, but the next year they got the job back. Maybe someone started paying alimony who wasn't paying it before. I mean, there are hundreds of reasons, but it's actually quite amazing how much the income for individual students and their families will vary from year to year.
Mr. Zetterberg, I imagine it works both ways?
It does work both ways. That's correct.
Representative Atkins, I had to do the FAFSA thing online with dial-up. Let me tell you, you know how frustrated I get. So.
Did you try picking up and just yelling?
I finally started the bonfire and had a blanket above the sauna, and I was sending a full picture. Go ahead. Representative Detmer.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative.
This is related. What is the graduation rate for our state, Minsky and University of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, currently the four-year graduation rate on the Twin Cities campus is 45%.
Mr. Lopez, do you know the number there?
Mr. Chair, I do not. I can get that fairly easily.
OHE has a recent printout of all of that, but would it be okay, Representative Detmer, if you got that?
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. We can get that after. I think that's
Mr. Chair, the follow-up to that?
Sure. Representative.
Mr. Chair, I'd be interested in also knowing of that grad rate, how many people receive financial assistance? So the breakout between those that received financial assistance versus those that did not.
Good point.
Mr. Chair, the office did actually do a persistence and retention study for certain financial aid applicants, and I can have Ms. Grimes return and talk about that if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, you described financial aid broadly. About 80% of students by the time they graduate receive some kind of financial aid if you include student loans. Among Pell and state grant recipients, which tends to be at the lower end of the income spectrum, they do not graduate at quite the same rate as those who have higher incomes. There are many studies associated with what correlates with dropping out of college. And the things that correlate with dropping out are not attending college straight out of high school, being an independent student, having dependent children, being a single parent, and working more than 30 hours a week are the ones that come to the top of my mind. There are seven altogether. If you control for the fact that low-income students are going to have more of those factors, by and large, the persistence rate isn't very different. But if you look at the statistics overall, because low-income families are more likely to delay attending college after high school and more likely to be independent students, have children, be single parents, and all that, yes, their persistence and graduation rates are not as high.
Well,
Yeah. I'm sorry, I apologize.
Oh, that's totally fine.
It wasn't my Edina prejudice.
I was going to tell you my Edina sauna story, but I'll pass. In terms of total dollars of student aid coming out of the state of Minnesota, do you know what percentage of those dollars end up at a private college as compared to Minsky, as compared to the university?
Mr. Chair, I do not have that off the top of my head, but we could provide that to you. We do have the data in our office.
I didn't represent any state grants or state loans or all combination of.
Combination of all kind of the chunk of money in student aid out of the Office of Higher Education.
There was a time when it went a little heavy to the private, but I don't know now, you know, what that is. Maybe sometimes you got that information back at the office.
Sure, I have it. I don't have it at the top of my head. I'm sorry.
Okay, Representative Mahoney, did you listen?
Mr. Chair, I was just kind of wondering on the U of M, how come they always talk about the U of M Twin City campus and none of the other four campuses that go along with them? Is there, like, are they separate, or is there one better than the other, or something like that?
We're going to, Representative Mahoney, we're going to have all the chancellors here with the president on Thursday, and I think, I don't know, did we even invite the Hormel Institute? I don't know. And we've got Rochester, I think.
I guess we'll wait for the big guns come and you can explain that.
But it is the flagship, you know. So the other ones are just light for, really right. Representative, okay, I guess that's it. questions? Are there other, Ms. Burgess, do you have anything else that you want to specifically address, or we can go into our specialists from each institution, and Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I could probably talk with them about this offline. I'm curious in how you determine room and board estimates that you have on your examples, but we can talk about that later after committee hearing.
Meld it into our formula? Yeah, we do it.
The room and board estimates that you hear, it's done by a state
formula. If I'm following you, it's done by a formula of some kind that I think we can reset it. So, if they're asking that question, the grant itself,
Mr. Chair, this is true. In the state grant model, the state does assign a living and miscellaneous expense allowance of $6,200. In the examples I provided, the room and board amounts here were actually selected, so these represent actual room and board rates at specific institutions. If you'd like, I know that Ms. Ruby can actually talk about how those rates are set.
Mr. Chair, so this is living on campus. This is not an apartment off-campus dwellings. These are actual costs of room and board on campus.
Mr. Chair and Representative, actually, room and board rates do vary. There are three types of rates that are included in a campus budget. On campus, if you were living in the dorm and had a certain meal plan and lived in a certain type of room, as well as off-campus rates will reflect such as business studies of what the market rate rents are for the surrounding neighborhoods, as well as some determination of what is reasonable cost for food and other expenses associated with living on campus. And then some institutions do also have a living with family rate, which may reflect what the student's portion of living at home is. But those, again, are set by the individual institution.
I think what I'm going to do is let each panelist up there now, because we've only got 15 minutes left, at least give their little presentation, and then I don't know who wants to go first. Ms. Rube, do you want to go first, or Mr. Lopez, do you want to go first?
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you. Before I begin, I want to the earlier question about the graduation rate at our state universities. I have the Minnesota Measures in front of me. That report indicates that the graduation rate at our state universities' six-year rate has been about 46.8%. I was asked to talk about the importance of state grant financing to our students, and I think you could see in the example that was provided by OHE, really the great importance that financing provides for many of our students. And in this example, if you can see, the student earns about $17,000 after the taking out the $3,600 family or contribution that the student is supposed to make. That really only leaves that student about $13,000 to live on and to pay the college expenses. If we took out the Pell Grant and the state grant, that student simply wouldn't be able to make it. When you look at students attending our two-year institutions and how they have managed to pay their college expenses over the last 8 years, reports from the Office of Higher Education indicate that between 1999 and 2008, total loans borrowed by or taken out by those students increased 183%. In 1999, those students borrowed $76,500,000. Fiscal year 2007, they borrowed $216 million, an enormous amount of increase. During that same period of time, state grants increased by only 79% for students attending our two-year institutions. Tuition went up by 91%. So I think you can see that with tuition going up 91%, state grant not really keeping up, our students are being forced to borrow more and more. And if you look at one example, the self-loan program, for example, in 1999, we had about 1,300 of our two-year college students borrowed about $4 million. In 2007, we had about 4,500 students borrowing $15.4 million. Tremendous increase. You see the same kind of increase in all of the loan programs, both the subsidized, the unsubsidized, Perkins, PLUS loans, private loans. Our students are really borrowing to finance their education. And so I think that the importance of maintaining the state grant as a means of lowering the need for students to borrow debt, to increase their debt really cannot be overstated. I think that's a really, really important way to guarantee access for our two-year college students as well as our four-year college students.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to work off the figure that's up on your screen there, and it's also a handout that you've been given. Representative Mahoney, this is for all four campuses. It's the financial aid pattern, actual financial aid pattern last year for all undergraduate students who were Minnesota residents and dependent students. So for the most part, this is the best picture I can give you of what it's like for your constituents who attend a University of Minnesota campus. Each bar represents a different family income level. The bar on the far left is less than $5,000. These are the lowest income students. And then each bar goes up in a $5,000 increment. The dark red bars down at the bottom are federal grants, state grants. The dark blue bars are institutional grants, university scholarships. The light blue bars are agency grants from outside foundations, the Rotary Club, so forth. The dark green bars are student loans, and the light green bars are parent loans. The gray bars are the resources that students and families generate on their own towards their instructional costs each year, and those gray bars do include work study as well as other kinds of student employment. As a policymaker, I'd like you to take some pride in the fact that this figure is not a random, all-over-the-place graph, but definitely shows very targeted patterns for how financial aid works, not only in the United States, but also in the state of Minnesota. And I hope you feel good about that. Obviously, most grant aid is targeted to the lowest-income students. And then very progressively, you can see as you go up income levels, less and less grant money is available, and it becomes necessary for higher income students to borrow more than lower income students do. We can argue over whether or not the cost of attendance is higher than it should be. We can argue over whether or not one of these bars should be less or more than what it is. But I think the pattern, in fact, is exactly what you would like to see. And I think that if this were done, I've seen this done for the private colleges, as a matter of fact. And I'm quite confident if it was also done for the community and technical colleges and the state universities, you would also see a similar pattern. We have more scholarship money available at the university than MinSCU has available, so you'd see that reflected in a different chart. But my point is you would see the same basic pattern. And this is based on actual data for last year, so it is as current as we can make it. As to the importance of the state grant program, it's obvious in the light red bars. That's the largest source of grant income, actually, for our students. What they get from the federal government is just a little bit less. In our university scholarship amount, if you look at it for all undergraduate students, not just resident students, and not just dependent students, is actually greater right now than what students receive from the federal government and the state government combined.
Can I just, Mr. Fire, can I just ask you, we have two graphs, and one has the agency grants, university scholarships,
right,
grants omitted. Is there a reason for the comparison, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Because I wanted to show you what happens if students don't graduate after in 4 years. If they don't graduate after 4 years, they lose all of their state grant support, they lose all of their university scholarship support, and they lose nearly all of their agency scholarship support, which is why the most important thing that students and families can do to control the cost of education is to graduate in 4 years. Obviously, if they do not, it leaves a tremendous hole in how they've been financing their education.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, would that same four-year graduation requirement apply to MinSCU as well, or is that distinctive to the University of Minnesota?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, in terms of state grant eligibility, the state grant eligibility is 4 years at all institutions.
Mr. Satterberg, did you have anything else? No. Mr. Satterberg, explain to me actually what an agency grant is. Is that like the Department of Revenue, or is it, what agencies are we talking about here? And I noticed they were used.
I didn't mean agency in that sense. I meant outside organization or agency. That's just the terminology.
Is it a private grant from like a research foundation or any private scholarship?
It would be a private scholarship from outside the university where that entity is actually picking the student, choosing the student. So, an example would be the Bureau of Indian Affairs is an outside agency that provides some scholarship support.
Or a local, like the Elks Club or the Northern Club,
exactly,
or whatever.
And many corporations also will help employees put money away for an education, and then that money also tends to come in as an agency award of some kind.
So the agency grants in your example here have been determined on a local or basis or a academic basis by someone.
Yeah.
A representative Clark and then Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you remind us when that 4-year graduation stipulation went into effect?
Well, we don't actually require students to graduate in 4 years. We just strongly encourage them to do so. And right now, about 2/3 of the students who graduate from the university do graduate in 4 years. It's tremendously different than it was 15 years ago, for example, and very different than it was just 5 years ago. And part of the reason, in fact, is because as tuition's gone up, students themselves are changing their behavior. They're realizing that the best way for them to control their costs is to make sure that they finish in 4 years. An extra fifth year literally will cost a student as much as $20,000 more And in addition, they're deferring a year's wages forever that they'll never make up.
If you remember, Representative Clark, we gave them a cheaper tuition, I think, at the U of T a few years ago. Can we, I don't want Ms. Ruby to get slighted here, so can we have Ms. Ruby do a quick presentation on the enforcement and then we'll ask.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was asked to speak to how the state grant program is utilized at St. Olaf on our campus.
Excuse me.
No, I've had a question, but I'm just wondering if it can be deferred until you get done. So we're on time. Go ahead, Ms.
Excuse me.
One comment I would like to make, there's been some discussion about the underutilization of the Achieve Scholarship. St. Olaf is a place where practically every student who's admitted, whose income falls below the $75,000 would qualify having attended a college prep curriculum. The issue is that the criteria for eligibility are tied to the federal academic competitiveness grant, so you're limited based on what those federal requirements are. The students we've had who meet the income criteria who don't qualify tend to be immigrant students who may not have the 2 years of foreign language because, quite frankly, they've mastered English well enough to be admitted to St. Olaf. We're not going to not admit them because they didn't take 2 years of a foreign language. And then the other requirement that holds students up is that the federal requirements are that, and therefore the state requirements are, that the student have a C, at least a C in every course in high school. Oh, I'm sorry, the state only has the requirement that there's a C in every course. And certainly sometimes students will get a D and then pull themselves back up and still be admitted to college, able to succeed, all those things. So those are the issues we've had. We were very aggressive in marketing it and getting it out to our students and making sure they were applying if we thought they'd be eligible. To speak to the program at St. Olaf, access is the most important priority of the financial aid program at St. Olaf. We have a strong institutional commitment to meet the full demonstrated need of all students who are admitted to the college. What does that actually mean? All these numbers we've been throwing around, it means we take that cost of attendance, we subtract the expected family contribution, and the difference is financial need. So then we meet that need fully with a mix of grants, scholarships, state aid, federal aid, work study, and loans. And I'll talk a little bit more specifically about that in just a sec. Among the private colleges, Carleton, McAllister, and St. Olaf are the three private colleges that still maintain that commitment to meeting full demonstrated need. Among the other private colleges, they meet full need for some of their students, but aren't able to afford to do that for all of their students. Now, we could have a long conversation, and I think we already did, about how that need is calculated, but that's for another day. I'd like to provide a quick overview of our enrollment and our financial aid programs and how our state grant recipients fit into the picture. On the 10th day of fall semester 2008, we had a full-time enrollment of 3,073. 63.5% of those students were needy and received almost $36 million in gift aid from St. Olaf. 54% of our currently enrolled students are from Minnesota, and a quarter of those students, 422 to be exact, are state grant recipients this year. So far, we've awarded a total of $1.48 million in Minnesota state grant funds, with an average state grant award of $3,500. Our Minnesota state grant recipients contribute to our socioeconomic diversity, as well as our commitment to first-generation students, who comprise 15% of our incoming class this year. Of our state grant recipients, 41% come from small-town Minnesota. In other words, not the Twin Cities metro area, Rochester, or Duluth. The median family income of our state grant recipients was $51,700. Now, in order to pay the tuition, room, and board at St. Olaf, of course, our students must receive funds from other sources as well. For our total cost, our tuition, room, and board is $42,200. For 96 of those state grant recipients, their costs are even higher because they chose to study abroad this year. And that's about a quarter of them, very similar to our institutional average of about 26% of our students who study off campus each year. Here's a quick snapshot of what they've received. 100% of them received gift aid from St. Olaf, totaling $9.8 million, with an average gift award amount of $23,400 from the college. Almost 53% of them also received some federal gift aid through the Pell Grants or the Federal AC Grants or the Smart Grant programs, with an average award of $4,100. They were also busy finding money on their own, those agency scholarships, those outside scholarships. Over 40% of them received gift aid from outside private foundations and organizations, totaling over $500,000 and averaging $2,900 per student. Now, on the self-help side of the equation, 91% of the state grant recipients borrowed, with an average loan among those who borrowed of $7,800 this year. The ones who didn't borrow are likely receiving such substantial outside gifts that they didn't need to do that. Now, a word about that average of $7,800 per year. As I said, we meet full demonstrated need. So if you were to look at Ms. Fergus's example of a private college, our contribution that we might expect from a zero contribution student, by the time you add it up, work study, loans, summer earnings, would be more along the lines of probably $9,000 or $10,000 instead of that $13,000 or $14,000. So certainly when we meet full need and we offer a loan, we don't offer $7,800 to meet full need. We offer more along the lines of an average of $5,500 to $6,000. But this gets back to families making the choice, because what I used was average accepted loan. Families make the choice to borrow to replace the contribution that's been calculated using those federal formulas. And then finally, in addition to the loans, our students work on campus. Those Minnesota State Grant recipients average awards of about $1,900, which is about 8 hours a week on campus. And about 16% of those state grant recipients had parents who borrowed parent loans. What we don't know is what parents are borrowing against their homes, which they likely won't be doing in the future, and how much our students are working off campus. But as you can see, paying for college expenses, whether it's at St. Olaf or any other college, it really is a mix of funds from different sources. The state grant is a very important piece of that mix. And the trick is to figure out who can afford to contribute how much. Now, I could bore you with some stories of students, because I have some very memorable state grant recipients that I've worked with, but I know we're limited on time, so I won't do that. Just know that they're graduating, they're making a difference in the state, and they're using your dollars well.
Okay. Well, thank you. You know, this is a really, you know, important part of our job here as members of this committee. And, you know, I've been thinking of possibly having little breakout committees to look at more in depth than we normally do because of the situation we are in this year. So I'm thinking of doing that too, even with the financial aid end of it. And I'll get input from the Republican side of the aisle if I decide to put three or five members on these committees, to get a couple from the Republican side, or one or two or four or three from our side of the aisle. And I'll talk to any of you individually that would like to be on, let's say, on the financial aid. Thinking of doing a little looking at MNSCU's budget and the university's budget and some of the bigger agencies we have. So members, come to me with any preferences you have on that and what you'd like to look at. And I was thinking I'd put Representative Slocum maybe in charge of a committee to look at the financial aid, because I thought she would be unbiased, not having really, but I don't know if she's unbiased or not. But, you know, I suppose I could put Representative Reinert in charge, and he's got the University of Minnesota Duluth, or Representative Reinert in charge, or Representative Bly, who's got private institutions, or Representative Hodges, who's got the big, huge St. Cloud, four-year institution. But I think I'll have Representative Slocum. Mahoney, you've been working for St. Paul Tech so much that I couldn't put you on there. So, Representative Slocum, we'll start with you chairing this little committee, and we're going to go in depth and look at those financial aid packages and see if we can improve on them, because from the governor's speech, it doesn't sound like we'll have much new money. I hope that's not the case, but we might have to use our money more efficiently than we even have in the past. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, just one thing that I think needs to be part of the picture when we're looking at this too, as the kind of jobs that a lot of these students are taking as a result of not having sufficient aid, or not having parental contributions or so on. I just know from some of the students that I work with, you know, they're working several jobs in addition to trying to be a full-time student. And I think I asked the question about the requirement for
finishing in 4 years, partly because of that, Mr. Chairman. People just can't do it, especially the lower income folks. And so I just want to put that on the table as one of the concerns that I have and one of the questions, because I think it's, you know, we're punishing people for not having the money, and they can't have the money because they have to work, or not have the time, and they have to work to get through. And I mean, it's just, I think it's something that should be revisited as a policy.
Well, we can certainly look at all of that as we're moving along. And Representative Haas had a question. Representative Haas,
Well, it was mostly a comment. It seems that you're saying now that it's possible to get through with college in 4 years. I can remember a few years ago, the private colleges were advertising, if you come to our college, we'll get you out in 4 years. And I know a lot of people that's had difficulty with getting the right classes in the right order. Or the only time they ever met their advisor was the freshman year when they bumped into them, and then they get around to graduation and they're short some other course. And it seemed like it was really a difficult task to graduate in 4 years. Are you saying that's not true now?
Does anybody want to? Mr. Zetterberg, is that to you, I guess? I don't know.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Haas. Actually, it is possible for students to graduate in 4 years. And again, those who do not pay a real price. A lot of people think that students who graduate in 5 or 6 years do so because they don't want to borrow money. The fact of the matter is they wind up borrowing more money than students who graduate in 4 years. Students who graduate in 4 years are working just as much as students who take 5 or 6. And we believe very strongly that the best way a student can control the cost of their education today is to finish a 4-year degree in 4 years.
Mr. Chair, follow up. In order for that to happen, then they have to have a 4-year plan. Is that happening with all the students, or just the students that are getting scholarships?
All of our students meet regularly with advisors. All of them are encouraged to have a 4-year plan as soon as they possibly can. That begins with orientation, not only with the student, but also with their parents.
Thank you.
And we've been told that by many parents that it's hard for them to coordinate the classes they need with when they're offered that. But I know, Representative Haas, when you went to school, I think it was only 2 years required for everything back then.
When you wanted to delete on my first computer, you shook it like that. That was a...
can I just add
go ahead.
One thing to the 4-year question? The question was asked earlier when it changed. We think it was about 5 years ago. It went from 10 semesters of full-time equivalent enrollment. So it's not just 4 calendar years. It's full-time equivalent enrollment, and it was cut back to 8 full-time enrollment equivalent semesters for cost reasons. I will say that at St. Olaf, where our 4-year graduation rate is 81.6%, I think is the most recent one, and for our students, ones who transfer out are likely transferring someplace else. But the group of students we do have who take longer than 4 years are our teacher education students. It is impossible for them to get their majors, that their education majors and their subject matter majors, and still get in their semester of student teaching. So we call them ninth semester student teachers. We maintain the institutional commitment, but we're unable to award them state grants for that ninth semester.
We should be out of here, but I'm going to represent Bly one last time.
Thank you to Ms. Ruby for, as your representative, I want to welcome you to the committee and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for coming, and members of the meeting adjourned. And Sarah,
yes.
You know, I get some input from you.